To find out what's really going on behind the music, sometimes you have to dig deep. I'm Dr. Mike, and on the new season of Going There, we're doing just that.
Art or music can be your escape and your therapy.
Going There is the podcast at the crossroads of music and mental health, where we have raw, meaningful conversations with artists like Noah Kahn, Julian Baker, Jason Isbell, Youngblood, The Head and the Heart, and Bishop Briggs.
I recently heard someone describe grief as glitter, where you'll clean it up and then you'll find little pieces.
By opening ourselves up to these real discussions about mental health, we can foster understanding and gain even greater appreciation for the music we all love.
For me, like, my favorite songs give me happy tears.
So join me and some of your favorite artists on the new season of Going There with Dr. Mike, brought to you by SoundMind Live and the Consequence Podcast Network. Subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. This is Aaron Carnes, the host of this podcast. After 4.5 years of weekly episodes, we are ready to stop creating In Defense of Ska. The podcast was meant to be a promotional push for my book In Defense of Ska, and it wound up taking on a life of its own. While Adam and I both love what we've accomplished with this podcast, we both feel compelled to focus our creative output elsewhere. The episodes we recorded remain evergreen, and we invite you to explore our back catalog, which will remain online thanks to the Consequence Podcast Network. I am working diligently on a new book, a novel called Little Black Book of Death. It's not ska-related, but it has a strong musical component. I also have a punk-themed script in the works. Adam is working on new music for Omnigon. We invite you to follow our respective projects and look forward to what the future holds. To keep in touch with my writing, follow me on Substack. That's aaroncarnes.substack.com. You can follow Omnigon on their social media accounts. Thank you.
Consequence Podcast Network.
This is In Defense of Ska. Our mission is to document the ska scene from its traditional roots through until its emergence as a diverse global genre. The influence of ska resonates through your favorite bands and artists in ways you might have missed. I'm your co-host, Adam D. of Omnigon and Asian Man Records band, Link 80. Joining me is your host, Aaron Carnes, renowned author of the book In Defense of Ska, which is currently available in an expanded second edition.
Adam, you know I love Bad Operation, right?
Yeah, I do too.
Well, as I've gotten to know the band, I've learned all about their backstory, and I find it really fascinating. I included this story in the second edition of In Defense of Ska. I also hosted a live panel in New Orleans last year with them and some other important people who are part of the story. So I got a recording of it as well.
And we've been sitting on this for a little while.
Yeah. It was a fun trip, by the way. I haven't been to New Orleans since the 90s, and it was fun to go visit New Orleans and eat.
Yeah, what did you eat this time?
I had two separate po' boys. You know, that's the part that just sticks out to me. The po' boys, yeah.
What type of po' boys did you get?
I got, you know, I'm not a seafood person, but for some reason, I like a fried shrimp po' boy. And then the second time I got fried catfish po' boy.
Nice.
I guess when it comes to po' boy, I like seafood.
Where'd you get your po' boy from?
Okay, I cannot remember their names, but one of them was in the French Quarter. It was a liquor store that Greg took me to that said was like the spot. And it wasn't even a proper restaurant. It was just a liquor store, and it was amazing. And the other one was near Brian Funk's record store, Sisters of Christ. It was like, that one was incredible. It was just like a little teeny tiny store. Amazing po' boy. Owner was like full on Cajun, and he was like, when I told him I was from California, he's like, they don't fry nothing in California. Everything's got avocados in it. I was like, all right, touche.
True.
Before we dive into this recording, it's kind of self-explanatory, but the gist of what I want to say to set this up is that Bad Operation, before they were Bad Operation, they were in ska bands, and then they experienced Hurricane Katrina. It had a pretty big impact on them. And from my perspective, it influenced the shape of the ska scene that was to come. And they had one of the most vibrant ska scenes in the late 2000s, which was a particularly tough time for the genre. So we kind of dive into all of this.
Yeah. Well, we're going to listen to Aaron's live recording from New Orleans right now.
Thank you all for coming. We're going to get this show on the road. This very chill show where we're just going to talk. So I wanted to say something as to why this particular event, we felt that it needed to happen. So Aaron has been so kind as to write a book in defense of ska. It's the second edition of the book. So the first edition, I mean, he can tell you more about it, but the second edition is out now. And Aaron made a significant effort to document specifically the New Orleans ska scene from 30 years ago up until now in a way that it had never been documented in the past. In the book, you will find pictures that some of which never really saw the light of day. You'll hear stories that, again, were mostly under or non-documented. And so it felt really important to us to try to have an event to celebrate the release of the book. The book covers a lot of ground, but specifically there is a chapter that's in reference to the scene here. As far as this panel goes, there's a few people that are a part of it that we thought of, but honestly, anyone who's in this room, we want this to feel as open as possible. If someone has something that they want to contribute or a memory or anything like that, we want it to be as open of a floor as we can. What else?
Oh, if you do want to contribute or talk, come get on the mic because we're recording it. So that way you'll actually be on the recording.
Right. Yeah, let's get into it.
All right, so we're going to kind of be a little fluid with who's up here. It'll kind of, we'll be loose. People will kind of come and go. I want to give you a little personal context for me since this is my connection to New Orleans, my friendship with Greg and D-Ray and you folks here. I didn't grow up here. I wasn't really aware of a lot of this history until I like dug into it. So I kind of have a view a little bit more removed, I guess you can say. And I was definitely, aside from being a fan of Bad Operation, there was parts of the history that impressed me and told me that it was special. And I'll give you like just a little thread, I feel like. It was when they told me about this, it was just kind of a casual mention, but they told me that the show Treme had used a Fatter Than Albert song. And the episode was aired in 2012 and it took place in 2007. And the reason that they used Fatter Than Albert was because the producers of that show worked tirelessly to represent the music of New Orleans of the time that the show was filmed. And they had a scene that took place like at a house show, like a bunch of high school kids were all together. And they determined that in 2007 in New Orleans, if a group of teenagers were getting together, they were going to be playing Fatter Than Albert. Now, to me, like they were kind of impressed that they got paid by HBO for this. But I don't think they realized before I got involved and started talking about this with them is that how unusual that was. There's no other city in the U.S. in 2007, if a show was made about that city, would the producers come to the conclusion that the kids were all listening to ska music. This was a distinct thing that happened in New Orleans. And a lot of it's because of the people that are here in this room today. So we kind of want to talk a little bit more about why that was the case. So where I want to start is we're going to start at just after Katrina to begin with. Right after Katrina, just a few months after Katrina, the very first ska show happens. And it happens on November 6th, 2005 at a place called the Maple Leaf Show or the Maple Leaf Bar and the Slackers come into town and they headline Fatter Than Albert Play, and another band called Captains of Industry are also there. So can you discuss what you remember about this show? Anyone that was at the show?
You want to field that one, Hunter?
The show in particular was the first show that, the first ska show after the storm. So that felt significant to us. It felt significant that the Slackers were coming to town and they wanted the show to be $3 because the Slackers wanted the show to benefit the bar. They just wanted people to go to the bar. They had a history with the Maple Leaf, and because of the concerts that Fatter Than Albert had been playing before the storm, we had somehow gotten the opportunity to open this particular concert. And considering the storm had hit, August 29th, 2005, this being November 6th, 2005, there was months where the city was destroyed, unoccupied in certain areas. Having a show, having a catalyst to get people together felt really significant.
Can you describe the what the energy was like in the room? Because like this was the first ska show after the storm, but I don't know if there were many shows regardless of genre before this, and what the energy of the people was like at this show.
You want to field that one, Lee? You were there.
All right.
Sorry. So this is of significance because November 7th, 2005 was my 21st birthday.
Could you say who you are?
I'm Leo Quinn. I'm friends with these guys. I've been going to shows for a while. So I was very sober at that show. And so I just remember the energy over there being... People were glad to see each other. Prior to the hurricane, you had no idea if you were going to see anyone again. Months leading up to that, you know, it was just like a reunion. There was a show, I think, between the storm and then that took place in Baton Rouge. Is that?
Yeah, there were some shows at the Dark Room, but yeah. I think that was kind of like the first New Orleans thing.
Yeah, Slackers at the Maple Leaf was, like a homecoming kind of thing. It just, I guess like... a feeling of release of energy, like pent up anxiety, like being able to go and dance to some of your favorite bands and see. Well, for me, Slackers at that time was my favorite band. So seeing them locally for $3 soon after a hurricane, pretty tight. But yeah, that's about all I can say for it.
Yeah, it was one of the first glimpses just like back in normalcy because we were blocked. We couldn't even get back into the city before that for months.
Yeah, when I talked to David Hilliard, the sax player of Slackers, for my book about this show, and he said that the National Guard or who was it that was occupying? You know, yeah, they were around and they basically attended the show too, and it took them a little bit, but they eventually loosened up and they also had a good time. They also like to what Greg was saying. Not only did Slackers play the show to benefit the club, they specifically didn't take any of the door. They said that the club could have 100% of the door. Like it was kind of a benefit in a way for the Slackers. I mean, they weren't trying to make any money at all, and I don't think they would have routed themselves to New Orleans had they not had a personal interest in like making sure the club could make some money, you know, in their time of need.
Yeah, it's hard for me to speak on, you know, the Slackers' prerogative on being there in that night, but it does very much so seem that they went out of their way to a degree to make that happen. And, I mean, I was 20, 19, you know, like at the time I couldn't really remember context of how shows were really coming about. It was just like, oh, shit, we're opening up for the Slackers. That's a big deal for us.
Yeah, the Slackers used to play every Lundi Gras at the Maple Leaf, and they actually have the Slackers in their jukebox labeled as New Orleans music.
Nice. All right, so let's go back a little bit. Let's give a little history leading up to this moment. And New Orleans ska in the 90s. That would be the most insignificant name in New Orleans ska in the 90s would be, who would that be, Travis?
Say that.
The most significant band of New Orleans in the 90s.
So like, how did my band?
I'm just giving you an opportunity to say that the Superflies was the most important band.
So there's a small story to how the Superflies even happened in the first place. Like, it was, I'm Travis, by the way. I was in a band called Superflies.
Yeah, come sit in the middle so you can see everyone.
Yeah. I mean, talk in the mic, too.
I just got a new hip, so I'm like gangster leaning. I'm going to stay on the mic. This is how old we are. New hips. So
here.
There was.
Is your mic on?
Yes. Okay. So in high school, I played the bass pretty good. And the guy that played drums in Superfly and Superfly's name is Ryan. And he was pretty good. And there was a guy who's no longer with us named Charlie Cooper, who ended up starting a group with a guy named Josh called Telephone Tel Aviv, which actually got pretty big. But he wanted to start a band, and we all went to Shaw. And for one reason or the other, they wanted to play ska music. Like, Dang Bro Y was like huge at the time. If anybody knows who Dang Bro Y is, they were like, I'm kind of too young. I had to sneak out to go see Dang Bro Y, you know. But they were kind of like a ska thing, maybe, but like freaky New Orleans weird thing. But there was a ska band called Kelly's Heroes, who kind of wasn't that great of a ska band at the end of their career. I'm not trying to talk shit. Like, they just had a lot of members come and go, you know. But they had a singer named EC, who was kind of like HR. He was fucking awesome. He was like a fucking badass, right? So Charlie and Ryan wanted to be in a ska band because of this guy, right? But I didn't get to see him until after that guy quit and they got a new guy named Sam Blackwood, who is like a really good musician. I don't know if y'all know who Sam Blackwood is, but shout out my old neighbor.
Ryan Blackwood.
His wife Jane, what's up? If they're listening. But he smoked vocally. Like, he was the shit. So I'm like, man, we gotta play this ska stuff. So Ryan gave me some Fishbone tapes, and I actually learned how to play like ska from listening to that Fishbone EP, from listening to Ugly. You know? And that's like, oh, I figured out that's like major scale. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting in my room playing that over and over and over and over, you know. So then we became a ska band after that, you know. I don't even know where I was going with this, guys.
All right.
No, we're
so right. So Kelly's Heroes, there. So okay, right. So if there was a ska show, so say like Mustard Plug's coming through, or MU330's coming through, they're gonna play with Kelly's Heroes. Mm-hmm. Because there's no scene here. There's nothing going on here. As far you had like this guy named Oi Boy, who got it. Do you remember Oi Boy? Wore suspenders. He wasn't from here. He was like from Boston, and a couple other guys that were like friends with Kelly's Heroes that would go to ska shows, right? So if there was anything ska happening, they were playing with Kelly's Heroes. So then we started to get pretty good. Any of our horn players, we got from the Shaw band, they didn't give a shit. They were not punk rock like us. They were not willing to like sleep in parking lots and skip meals for cigarettes, you know. So it ended up becoming, in long story short, Superflies, which is the four of us, me, Kirk, Ryan, and Chad. Kelly's Heroes actually stopped wanting to play with us because we would play shows and the bands on tour would want to hang out with us. They would want us to open up with them, and we, and it was like kind of a punk rock thing where like it was more like punk rock and ska, you know, than just like ta-ka-ta-ka, which is no problem with that, you know. But we kind of could collect from the punk rock scene and the ska scene.
And you were a better hang.
Man, I tell you what, if there was like, no, I'm not talking shit that way, I'm not. But if there was a band, if there was a ska band in existence at that time, they stayed at my house. Like they stayed, and like you said, like how we would do, we would do it for nothing. We would be like, y'all are taking the money. That's just our way. Like, you know, yeah, no, Musher Plug is getting paid. There was only 80 people or 50, 80, shit, man. There was only like 30 people. They're going to get all the money, you know. That's kind of, like, I mean, you can ask Mr. Brian Funk here. This, we're not doing this shit for money, you know. Like I have a new hip, and it's not from playing the bass, you know, or the guitar or whatever, you know.
So the Superflies, you guys get a pretty big fan base going on in New Orleans, and then you get signed to Fueled by Ramen at a certain point too.
Right. So, the way that happened was you had the Fallberg Center, mm-hmm. and that was like the spot. That was like the mecca. That was fucking punk rock. Right, like it was crazy, you know. It was weird. I don't really know what was going on upstairs in that place or the people that lived there. There was a dude named Fred, a guy named Fred. Do y'all remember? Kind of had an afro. I don't know. It was crazy.
It's like a flop house.
I guarantee you, it was a fire hazard. It was everything. You know, there was wood everywhere. You know, people smoking, fucking crazy shit. But yeah, man, no, like most shows were happening there, you know, occasionally like Monaco Bob's or other places that are on around. But we ended up, I can't remember if we played with Les and Jake, like, at Jimmy's, and dude, there was literally, like, nobody there. No, like, this is LTJ in, like, 96?
Wasn't there, I think there was, like, a hurricane or a hurricane warning?
That's right. There was a hurricane coming. There was literally nobody there. At Jimmy's. Then when they came back into town, they played at Fallberg Center. And that, for whatever reason, the things lined up where I think I was like graduate. I think it was like 96. Like I'm just like everybody was waiting on me to graduate. Like everybody else is older. So like I got out of school. We ended up playing with them. They're like, they had a band called Pez that couldn't tour with them anymore. It was just a regular punk rock band. Had nothing to do with them and their Pez shit or whatever they had going on, you know. Dude, those guys, man, they sold yo-yos and all kinds of shit. I'm like, wow, man, these guys are fucking busy. Anyhow, that band dropped off. Pez couldn't play. So they're like, can y'all go on tour? And I was just like, yeah, we can, you know. And I'm like, we don't have a ride. I don't have a license. You know, like you said, you're 18, 19, you're like, yeah, sure, yeah, we'll do it and we'll figure it out. We ended up like borrowing Kirk's grandparents' Suburban, and like that was it was totally insane. Like that's hard for me to explain what that was like. That was awesome. I mean, it was like, imagine like playing East Coast. LTJ is like just starting to blow up, you know, and these are like your fucking heroes or whatever, right? So it's like, wow. Yeah, that was wild.
So you're on Fueled by Ramen.
Yeah, they signed and us. Then they basically were like,
and you released Rambardin on Fueled by Ramen in like 97?
Sure,
and you also did the Mullets Across America tour.
Right, that is also a fact.
It was Impossibles, Hippos, Homegrown.
So when we got signed, we were the third band signed. It was the Hippos, which Ariel is now, that was like the main guy in that band.
Yeah.
He is like,
he's a pop producer.
He's in Vampire Weekend.
He's not in Vampire Weekend, but he produces, he plays with them sometimes.
You know, the last time I saw Ariel, I can't remember which band played with him, but it was at, I don't know if y'all booked the show, it was at the Cypress Hall, and we were getting, we got shook down by street crimes. And I remember telling the street crimes, like JP's had a unit called street crimes, and all these guys did was work out and be cops, right? So like we were in the, we were behind the Cypress. Do y'all remember Cypress Hall, right? I didn't dream this, I don't think, right? So like, yeah, we're in the back, like listening to Stereo, like Impossible's next band, like Rory's next band, and Ariel's showing me Stereo, and the cops, boom, 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 get out. And I remember telling the cops, like, I mean, man, you can go through this whole thing. You're not going to find a lick. You're not going to, these guys don't even eat cheese. Cause like I was making, which is kind of the truth, you know, like being vegan was not like a hip thing to be back then, but they're from Southern California, you know, and I was, and yeah, I just remember that happening. That was kind of funny.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
Don't you deserve a Medicare plan you can count on? Well, you can count on a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. Enjoy reliable coverage and low out-of-pocket costs with a Medicare Advantage plan from UnitedHealthcare. And if you have a chronic condition like diabetes, chronic heart failure, or a cardiovascular disorder, you may qualify for a UnitedHealthcare Complete Care plan with plans that fit your life today and as your needs change tomorrow. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare plans at uhc.com/Medicare.
Fauburg was the place, but Fauburg closed in 98, right?
Right. They started having shows at this place called Cypress Hall, yeah. Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's where we're gonna talk about that transition from Fauburg. So where they were
having shows at Cypress.
Okay. Before. But Cypress kind of became the spot, right?
But it was like the spot where like metal band, like Shell Shock and the kind of shit that was like before my time.
It was in Metairie.
So Fauburg, that's here in town, right?
Fauburg is like
downtown.
That's downtown. So, but Cypress is in Metairie, so that's not in the center of town. The punk and ska scene kind of shifts.
I would say Metairie is the center of.
What? I'm really trying not to make fun of anything. Like I'm like trying to be more respectful.
No, go ahead.
Okay, in my life these days. One thing I do miss about being in a ska band is you can just be fucking ridiculous person. Like you can say dumb things. You can have fun. It's all about fun, really, you know, and like giving some, you know, somebody something to listen to or something to do, you know, that's not shitty.
Does anyone have a ska band that they can have Travis join?
I don't know, man. I think I'm kicked out of the bass club, man. I'm like on guitar now. It's messed up. I don't know what happened to me.
Call it the new hips.
It's changing. Things are changing.
So Brian or Greg or whoever wants to comment on this, when would you say that the shift happened to Cypress when that became sort of the main place where...
When they shut?
Yeah, I mean, probably 98 because Fauburg Center sort of like quick, like overnight basically shut down.
Do you know why it shut down?
I think they were renting it out as like a flop house.
Okay, so it got busted.
I think people were living upstairs. Like the guy Francois that leased it was like subletting rooms and stuff upstairs, and yeah, they basically.
Oh no, it was sketchy. 100% perfect punk rock.
Well, sure. Yeah, when I was going there in like 96, 97, like the cops would come and raid it. They'd line people up on the street and.
Blanket arrests, like that type of thing. Everybody,
you'd see
here,
them coming. You turn around, and walk the other way because you'd see them grabbing people and throwing them up against the wall.
Man, I got good at it. I missed every raid on the West Bank. In any West Bank bar, man, I'm like, oh, I see them coming. I'm out later, guys. You know, good chop. They gave us good chops.
Short Butts? I don't think there's anyone from Short Butts here.
I think Cypress Hall was like the main spot for a while because the .07 guys, Marshall. Yep. Was basically booking shows at the time.
Okay.
And so he started booking all the stuff at Cypress. That's when I don't think he never did anything at the Fauburg Center, but when Cypress became a thing, it was like Alkaline Trio and Link 80 and...
Can you describe Cypress for anyone that hasn't been there? What was Cypress Hall
it's
like?
It's like a VFW hall, okay. Basically. It's like if you put a VFW hall on top of a fish storage freezer.
You had places to park, you know? It was cool.
I would not say it was cool.
No, it was uncool. But it worked.
State Palace was active around that time, too, though. They had Devil Dolls Productions booking all the... A lot of the other touring acts.
Yeah, so
there.
Like Deborah was like the professional promoter in town doing like the bigger stuff. So if a band had like, you know, a $900 guarantee, it would be Deborah putting it on somewhere semi-legitimate, a club or something.
Dude, I don't know, man. I saw a lot. I've seen so many. Dude, I saw like Guttermouth. Mm-hmm. I think, dude, like Slapstick, Broadways, all those bands at Fallberg Center, like...
Yeah, well, Deborah was doing Fallberg stuff too. Yeah, and then at some point she sort of like leveled. I think she get based. You know, Fallberg Center was a place where like you had to bring a PA, you had to have people do X, Y, and Z.
No air.
And so at some point, I think she just decided, oh, I don't want to do all this kind of stuff. I want to just show up and run the show. I don't want to have to like get a PA and do all this other crazy stuff. And then plus, I think with all the Fallberg Center, like. It constantly getting raided and shows getting shut down, or just people getting grabbed. Like, yeah, it was like a hassle.
It was punk rock for sure.
So with Cypress, the scene, you know, this is, we're talking several years between Fauberg closing and Katrina. When I talked to Alex from Short Bus, he told me that his biggest show that he did there was the Ska's Dead tour, which would have been February 2005, so same year, like, you know, like probably 6 months, 7 months before Katrina, yeah. And that was Streetlight Manifesto, Voodoo Ghoul Skulls, and Fatter Than Albert,
yeah,
right? What do you got there? Okay.
So it was supposed to...
It was supposed to be at the Southport Hall?
Yes. Yeah, it was supposed to be at Southport Hall. It got moved to Cypress.
Now, wasn't there an issue where it wasn't allowed to be all ages there and somebody called and basically you guys got busted so you had to, like, last minute move to Cyprus?
You'd have to ask him.
That's what
really
I heard.
Remember.
But it was a last minute move, right?
Yes.
Yeah. He said, and you can verify if this is true, that it was just so busy. It was so packed that it was, like, shaking, like the floors were shaking. Yeah, Greg's shaking his head, yes.
So specifically, Streetlight Manifesto had done a show with Big D and the Kids Table in 2004. I'm not going to find the flyer right now, but it's in the stack over here. But Streetlight Manifesto was one of the more popular sort of, I guess you could say, up-and-coming bands of that in that little pocket of time. And then so getting Voodoo Glow Skulls, MU330, Streetlight Manifesto all in the same package was a huge deal for anyone interested in the ska punk scene at the time. For us to be able to open was also a big deal for us. And it also does, I mean, I think what you're getting at is that this scene didn't just like spring up out of nowhere post-Katrina. There was active, vibrant shows. I mean, there certainly were... I didn't count, but I mean, there must have been 500 people, you know, in the building at Cypress for this show. That's February 2005, very well attended.
So Fatter Than Albert, where were you guys at this point? You guys had been around for a few years. You guys had kind of developed somewhat of a scene around you guys?
We started at the beginning of 2004. So we had been a band for a year and 2 months at that point. Yeah.
Did you feel like you had a fan base at that point, or were you just kind of just trying to play shows whenever you could?
I mean, we had a fan base. I mean, it was definitely a thing where partially, you mentioned Alex, who was doing Short Bus. He was kind of the production person putting on these bigger shows, and we were getting the ask on a somewhat regular basis to do these shows when the bigger bands were coming through. So, yeah.
Okay. So Kira, I want to. Can you come up, steal somebody's mic?
Sure.
When you guys get out of here.
I think Travis's mic might. We'll maybe nix that one. Not that I don't love you, Travis. It's just this one's not working as well.
Okay, let's We're going to get into Katrina and the Ska Revival shows of 2006. But let's explain first what Big Top is, because this is where it happens.
Oh, well, the Big Top was a, it was an art gallery. It was a place that had a stage and a liquor license, and we were all very...
Can you explain me your relationship to Big Top?
I created it.
Okay.
And worked it and was there all the time. I had two business partners as well. Then they had families, and I was a single person, and so I just did all of that. And it was a place where I wanted everybody's creative voice to be able to be heard. And it was a community building center to begin with. It was, the real name was Three Ring Circus Arts Education Center, but we called it the Big Top. And so we had everything. I did some numbers. I did 290 events open to the public. And it could be anything from Brit Wit Night to come drink with Kira and watch British comedy, or you could come see a show. I mean, what was great about those shows was start at 6 o'clock, 6:15, there would be a mosh pit going right on time. I've got my earplugs in, and I'm doing my accounting, watching this all happen. But it was predominantly a place. It didn't matter whether it was visual art or theater or burlesque. But all three of us, of the Three Ring Circus gals, we all really, our main priority all of our life was to go see live music. Mm-hmm. And the real important thing for us with our liquor license was to make sure that we were able to have people who were not 21 in our place. And having shows with kids from 11 to, you know, to adults was really important to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to us, not just to me, but it was something that was just, because I didn't have that opportunity, even though when I was young, which was a long time ago, 18 was the drinking age, and that was in Texas. And so I was going out when I was 16, you know what I mean? But that was all illegal. But I was legal. And honestly, I hope that I was a place where parents felt comfortable dropping off their kids. Mm-hmm. In fact, one day, this young girl comes in. She brings in her dad, and she goes, Dad, come here, come here. She brings him. She brings him to the stage. She goes, that's where I skanked last night. It was the cutest thing.
You got a big talk. Wait, first, before you, I want to hear your big talk story, but first, we kind of brushed over this. Superfly's getting into the 2000s, you become a community, and you're kind of moving away from ska, right?
Yeah.
Turning your back on ska? Betraying
ska?
Yeah,
almost like 100%. And I'm sorry.
It's okay, to
everybody. Basically, okay. I'm trying to say this in a way that doesn't make me look stupider. One of those tours. So, okay. Superflies was put in with the Hippos and the Impossibles, pretty much. That we were like brother bands, right? Like, the Hippos were Southern California. The Impossibles were like this Weezer Scott awesomeness thing, right? And we were like the fucking white trash kids that everybody knew was just like lucky to be, literally, like, it's not a joke, like, we're lucky to be there, right? So, you know, we did a lot of shows with those three bands. Sometimes, like, the Impossibles would go do something and the Hippos would go do something. But we basically were those three bands for a lot of shows, and it was really cool. Like, we're like, we could mess with each other, like sing each other songs to each other, you know, that type of thing. Like, our van would break down and we got to ride, like, we're going to ride with these guys kind of thing, and vice versa. You know, somebody's got a flat, jump out, let's change his tire type of thing. Like, I don't know if that's normal or what that, but that was normal. Like, we were all, everybody was cool, you know? So, when we do get to California on that Mullets Across America tour, like, the Hippos are huge, man. They were like fucking, I don't know. Can we curse? Can we say?
You can.
They're like, I don't know the story exactly. If like, because both them and Real Big Fish were from Southern California, and that's that sound.
I think they're that, I think they were from L.A. and because really
Orange County.
From
Orange. I think it's called Orange County Sound. They called it OC Sound.
Yeah.
So I don't know if Ariel and those guys started making that sound first, or Real Big Fish did it, or whatever, and then they like. The next thing you know, like Real Big Fish is on Nickelodeon or whatever. Like I don't know, but I don't know where I was going with that. But I know that they were huge, man. Like I remember playing like a couple of shows. Like there was a show in Riverside. It was like fucking like 1,200 people there for like the Hippos, man. And we would just all mess with each other, you know. We're like. These guys are like rock stars. Like these guys are rock stars in Los Angeles, you know? Like we're like literally whenever we played like in LA, it would be like unlock the door, start. Like they unlock the door and we're starting. You know? Like people are coming, they're coming in and we're like, we want them walking in the sky or something, you know? Like so like me and Kirk are like, I remember on that way back, like we're like, yeah, no, this ain't, we're already too late. Or whatever we're thinking, however we're thinking, you know, like, it's like, it's time to, this ain't it, you know, like, because we come home and play in front of 80 people, and I'm not complaining, because it's awesome, it was great, but it was just like, well, it just seemed like it was time, like, I blame it all on Kirk, it's all Kirk's fault, all right. Like, everything good is Kirk's fault, and everything bad is Kirk's fault. That's what I'm saying about. That's right. That's what happened there. Like, so I should have never heard Joan of Arc.
If anybody wants to come in further and find a seat, there's some open seats and whatnot in here if anybody
cares to come in.
Like, back in those days, you had to get a pamphlet, a Jade Tree pamphlet, you know, and then now you're like, it's graduated from that.
So I want to talk. Okay, so... I want to move on to the Ska Revival shows at Big Top in 2006, but I think we need to kind of explain Katrina and the role of Katrina and the effect of Katrina. Does anyone want to say their... I know it's a little bit of a tough thing, but does anyone want to explain their Katrina story as we kind of go into coming back from Katrina?
I will at least say that... at the time, so I referenced the show in February. We had gotten to a point that we were playing in front of 500 people, which, or something like that. It felt like there was something vibrant. It felt like there was something important. And it felt significant that Fatter Than Albert was getting to do any of that. And so when the storm hit, I do personally remember a drive to get back to the city and keep the band going.
Where was everybody? Like, well, let's kind of just say, like, where was everybody evacuated to?
Where'd you evacuate?
Atlanta. Well, first Clarksdale, Mississippi to have barbecue, and then to Atlanta.
Yeah, there you go. It is Hunter. So I was all over the place. I lost my house in the storm. Originally evacuated with a girlfriend at the time to Delhi, Louisiana. Made my way down to Baton Rouge, stayed at a two-bedroom apartment with like 15 people for I don't know how long. Greg came to rescue me. I slept on Greg's living room floor. He lived in a one-bedroom, so I slept in the like kitchen living room area for a few months. Yeah, at least 2 months. I don't even remember where I went from there. I was all over the place. I didn't have a home for a good long time.
Yeah. You were in Jackson, Greg, originally evacuated?
I had evacuated to Jackson, but made it back to the West Bank maybe 2 months after the storm. But yeah. And
I ended up, we went to Mississippi, and then when we lost power there because the storm got all the way up there, when the TVs came back on and we saw what had happened, then we went to Illinois to stay with family, and we stayed up there for a couple of weeks, and then ended up having to come back to see what was up. And even then, when we came back to my parents' house in Slidell, which is 40 minutes north of New Orleans, we still didn't have power, and shit was still fucked up. and we still didn't have power for like 2 weeks after that. And it was like I had just graduated high school that year, and I had just moved into my dorm room to get out of my parents' house and into New Orleans finally, and I had found myself right back in my parents' house with no power even.
I will say this, I was turning 40 at the time, and I was thinking to myself, why, what am I doing? I had started the Big Top, and I had hurricaded to Atlanta. I got back at the end of September, and at the Big Top, the lights were on, the beer was cold, the phone was working, and I thought to myself, well, this is a real clear sign. You need to continue what you're doing.
So can you explain, anybody in Fatter Than Albert, can you explain why you felt so driven to get back and get Fatter Than Albert going again?
To put it simply, like, being in Fatter Than Albert was my dream, you know, and to an extent it still is my dream to be in a ska band that is fun and people are enjoying. But to have what we had at the time, I mean, the band Fatter Than Albert started in 2004, and we're talking the next year, we find ourselves in this unprecedented sort of situation for us, at least, and it just felt like I personally wanted to do anything within my power to get a practice going, like play a show, figure out where everyone was. Like, we were all displaced in a variety of ways, and I think that the band felt like a reason to get us together. And also part of the catalyst is, like, it is in my nature. Like, if most of the people in this room have probably been handed a flyer by me, you know, I don't know, countless times maybe. Like, I do genuinely love the idea of getting people together. It's not just about promoting myself. It's about promoting the idea of there's this event where people can have catharsis, can have joy, can, you know, and Fatter Than Albert was making that happen in some way, shape, or form. And I felt very drawn to nurture that, to bring it back to center. And I certainly didn't have like an 1,000 feet view up of whatever was going on at the time. I just knew we need to play another show. We need to get back to the city. We need to make something happen. And
yeah, and I mean, I just dealt with a lot of the trauma of the Storm Bear writing songs, so we had to play them.
Yeah, there's some songs specifically about the storm and what you were dealing with on Fatter Than Albert.
Yeah, I would say probably at least half of The Last Minute, the title track specifically.
I mean, imagine the age of being high school, just out of high school. It's a pretty major thing to deal with at that time.
Yeah, and the title of that record is written about a friend of ours that we lost at that time. Like, the storm caused a lot of events to happen in this person's life where he got in trouble with the police and he had substance abuse issues, and it was just this like spiral that he could not find himself out of. And mm-hmm. So that whole record was basically dealing with all of those thematically, lyrically, everything.
Yeah, and there was a lot of that too. So I mean, Dan was kind of the first friend that we lost to the trauma, and just a lot of ODs and suicides, and it was just a really hard time to just get through.
We'll be right back after this.
So Fatter Than Albert plays the show with Slackers, which we already discussed, and that's a few months after Katrina. But in January 8th of 2006, you play, I think this is the first show you guys do at Big Top, right?
That's correct, yeah.
And you call it Ska Revival. You're not calling it a revival of ska. You're kind of saying this is a revival in New Orleans via ska. Like, you're kind of trying to say we're getting back on track and stuff, right?
Well, after Katrina, we played Fatter Than Albert played in Baton Rouge primarily, because so many of our friends, there were shows happening in Baton Rouge. Hunter was living in Baton Rouge for part of the time. And so, like, the tagline of, like, New Orleans ska revival, the idea is the show had to be all ages. I wanted it to be in Orleans Parish, and it was all ska bands, and it was the first show of that nature after the storm. So this is, yeah, January 6th, you know, after the storm had hit. And, you know, we had a hunch that it would go over well, but we didn't know exactly how it would turn out, how many people would come, or like what the feeling would be like. And it was Flaming Tsunamis, Samurai Deli, Screams of Triumph. Did Angry Banana play that one?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So, but Fatter Than Albert were not a... You guys didn't, like, really headline shows at that point, right? So this was sort of a first for you to be, like, we're the headlining band.
It wasn't... We did headline some, for sure, and those were more in Metairie. We would play at Airline Lions Home or Cypress, but it wasn't always common for us to headline. But this definitely was... felt like a lightning rod of, okay, let's try to get everyone to this particular show. And I mean, the Big Top, I wanted to book that show there because Brian had already done shows at Big Top, and you know, I can't even remember if I had been to one there or not. But
was Brian your connection? I'm curious, Kira, what you remember. Was Brian your connection to Big Top, or how did this happen? Why did Big Top become your thing?
Didn't you just come in and say, I want to play here? And I say, sure, let's do it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm like the DIY promoter guy, so I'm always right. Like looking at just random spots where stuff happens. So I came to the Big Top because my friend was either in an art show or we were just going because she's into like fine art stuff. So we went to a gallery show,
right.
And I think there was a band playing, and I was like, oh, there's a band playing. I wonder if I could do shows here. And that's it. I mean, it's like if I go somewhere and there's like a open mic thing or something, I'm like, oh, we can do shows here. Who do I talk to? And that was just my MO for the longest time, just finding spaces across town where I could do all ages stuff.
Do you remember the very first show, the bands that you booked on the very first show?
At the Big Top? No.
I don't either.
I
just remember...
It might have been one of those lightning bolt shows.
It might have been. I just remember thinking to myself, I really like this guy. He has his shit together. I'm not joking.
Trust and believe.
You know, I'm dealing with artists and musicians and theater people. Come on.
I do have my shit together a little bit, but I don't know. The really liking me, that's like a first. Usually it's like...
Brian.
I'm a little bit harder to crack with most people.
Well... Maybe I like people who don't blow hot air up my ass.
Yeah, I mean,
does not blow hot air.
No. This is why I decided to come here. It's just
because he's a lovely.
I mean, I always got along great with the Big Top people because they were also like no nonsense.
Yeah, we don't want to mess around. Yeah. It's like we want to get shit done. We want to be respectful and we want to like make an impact. And honestly, I think we did what we set out to do.
So when you met Greg and D-Ray, I mean, they were pretty young at the time. They were like, what,
oh my God,
19
babies.
Maybe? Yeah.
Yes.
What was your impression of them?
I love them too. You know, he's talking about the joy and enthusiasm, and really what they were talking about is building community, hence Community Records, but they're talking about building community. And one of the reasons why I love them is that not only they were there for themselves, I deal with, again, musicians and artists, and there's a lot of egoism in that. They didn't have any of that, and they were always looking out for their friends, no matter what. And I could always come to them and say, dude, I can't believe somebody just tagged my dresser. I got so upset because the only thing that I had, it was the only thing, because I lost everything in Katrina, too. Mm-hmm. I lost everything in Katrina except for the Big Top. The Big Top was fine, and I got so mad, but now it's in my house, and I'm very happy that it's tagged. But just, you know, doing everything from like, say, hey, we've got to be responsible for these are kids here doing this, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's knuckleheadery everywhere. Yeah.
What was, What was the it was a block party that y'all played. Was that 2007?
2008.
The first one.
The one that Black Belt.
Black Belt was 2008.
Yeah.
And then, so I guess the band after Community, y'all had us play, and we played and it was cool, but these guys are playing outside, and there's like how many people there? There's like, it could have been 500,000 people. These guys.
So this is what you're referring to.
He's talking about the first block party at the Big Top, 2008. So the first show that Fatter Than Albert played at the Big Top was 2006. We're talking 2 years later. It was Chris Murray, Fatter Than Albert, Emergence, which was out of Samurai Deli, We Are the Union, Thou, Safety, Stereo Hype, Maddie Ruthless, Citizen Dread, Sticky Bandits, Angry Banana, Screams of Triumph, Black Belt Band, The Stellaphonics, Spring Break Shark Attack, and the Tata Destroyers. $10 or $8 with a donation of non-perishable food or clothing. All donations plus 25% of the profits from the event will go to the New Orleans Mission. All ages, 1 o'clock to 11 o'clock.
So we played... Like early, we packed up. I don't even remember y'all playing. But yes, Katrina was fresh. And if you had a DRUG problem, it was coming out of you. And all I remember was y'all played Shit Is Going to the Dogs.
That was because we knew it was a big deal to us to be able to play with Black Belt Band because y'all were our... you know, inspiration, so, you know, so we were like, we need to play Shit Is Going to the Dogs. That way Travis and the crew are going to see us play Shit Is Going to the Dogs.
So
at our fucking...
I'm like, don't know anything about any ska scene at all. I just thought it was dead. Like, I didn't even know about y'all. Like, I had a friend that worked at Martin Wine Cellar. And he's like, oh, I got some guys here that know your band. I'm like, okay, that's cool. I always just think people are messing with me. But I was in the crowd, and my friend Nikki's next to me, and he's like, they're playing a Superfly song. I was like, get out of here, you know? And then I heard that, and there's like, I don't know how many people there. And I
well,
was
it
just
had
like,
the, it had the intended
insane.
Effect.
It was
it had the intended effect.
I was mind blown. I was like, I was kind of wishing I would have been sober at that moment.
That was the first moment you realized that this connection had been made.
I was like, oh, God damn it, man. Was it, you know,
what did we
dropping the ball again. Here we go, you know, perennially dropping the ball.
So back to the ska revival show in 2006, though. Can you explain what that show felt like in terms of, you know, what the energy was and what it felt like for the kids there?
If I can just say one thing.
Yes.
The art was all completely wonky after the show. That's how much people were dancing and enjoying themselves. The art physically moved. That's about 200, 250. It was packed.
And that was before the big doors were open.
Like,
we didn't do that until years
that
later.
We didn't do that until
block party.
The block party, because yeah. I was like, "Oh, look, guys, look at this."
Yeah, how many people
at the block party? About 500.
Oh yeah, I mean it kind of varied over the years, but that one, I mean, it was probably around close to 500 or 600.
Because there were two stages: there's the outside one, and then which is a larger one, and then the smaller one.
So 2006, early 2006. Katrina, I'm sorry, New Orleans isn't exactly back to normal, right? There's not...
It's still not.
Well, you know, it particularly was not back to normal. And there wasn't a lot... Like, people weren't... people still hadn't returned, and a lot of stuff wasn't open, right? So...
Yeah.
So, Big Top doing these shows... Can you explain that? How Big Top doing these shows, how maybe... There wasn't a lot of other stuff that maybe like people under 21 could do at that time.
It's almost hard to speak on it because being that age, I mean, we were in our early 20s and our life was trying to book and play and have these shows. So yeah, to us, it felt like the center of the universe, but...
Right, it was kind of like blinders were on. There wasn't really anything else that needed to be going on. It was kind of like hanging out, having band practice, and then booking shows and going to those shows.
But so, Kira, from your point of view as an adult, did you talk to parents? Was it... Were they... Did they feel like, okay, this is okay for my kids, but I'm not sure about if I want them around town or, you know, what was kind of the attitude?
Honestly, I think, honestly, that people trusted. Because there are a couple times when stupidity happened, and then I would step in and say, this is not acceptable behavior, and either deal with the parent or deal with the child and say, you know, I feel like it was a very safe place.
I think y'all did a great
honestly,
job.
Honestly, I don't think
people,
too many
yeah,
people.
Yeah, people would get dropped off by their parents all the time.
They would.
And it was like a thing where somebody had a problem, they had someone to come talk to.
Right.
And they were always met with a level-headed, like, reasonable person who runs the place. Like, sometimes you drop kids off at these places, and then it's like, who's in charge?
Right.
Who do I talk to if something does go wrong? And at the Big Top, there was at least one, if not multiple people that they could talk to.
Absolutely. The bartender behind, whoever was working behind the bar, whether it was me doing that too, or, you know, we were always very, we were like a shark. You know, one of the best things that I found was somebody had put their Strawberry Hill in the toilet tank. You know, like Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. I was like, oh, okay, you got your alcoholic Kool-Aid in here. This is good. You know, but for the most part, people were respectful because I requested that. And it was an art gallery, too. You know, there was people's, other people's, artistic vision there as well. So I'm hoping that, you know, when you ask for people to behave, they behave.
I guess what I'm getting at is that this thing grew at an extraordinary time, at a time when maybe it would have been hard for something like this to grow, but it was set up in such a way as that it maybe allowed it to grow and flourish. You know, that it was a place, a cathartic place, it was a safe place. People were maybe more on edge, you know. I'm sure your parents were probably dealing with their own version of trauma that was very different than the trauma you were dealing with?
Yeah, my dad had global amnesia during Katrina. It was incredibly stressful. Like, all the kids were going through it, and we were an outlet. Like, there was a place where they can come, and we just put on a wild show, and they can go fucking nuts.
At that time, everything was a victory. So in a way, like, if you got a show going, it was going to pop off. You know, like, I worked at a restaurant. We were, like, the fourth restaurant open. And I had never been busier in my life. Like, it's like people want to come and go there. They want to, like... So, in a way, it's going to help. It kind of helped things out. Also, there's this weird thing that happens in this city where there's just, like, so much stuff going on where, like, this scene is, like, completely just, like... It's not really respected, you know, because there's so much stuff going on. In this, like, you can walk down Frenchman Street and you got like 20 awesome musicians playing and like hole in a wall, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was kind of cool. Like, I was like thinking, like, fuck, man, like, if community was together, we'd just cry Katrina and be huge, and, you know.
We can look. We're looking at this in retrospect now as being like cathartic, but at the time.
That didn't register.
You didn't think of it as cathartic?
No.
At the time?
I think it was just, and like you were, I think what you were also getting at is that there really isn't still a lot of all ages shit for people to do in New Orleans.
Yeah.
The all ages DIY shows are pretty much it. I mean, you can go to Skate Country, you can go eat pizza, but like,
it was wild. It was definitely like a survival. Everybody was in survival mode. Like they were saying, there's National Guard driving around.
And yeah, like you said, we're not like, we're going to go to the show and feel some catharsis because we're 19. I don't even know. I don't think I knew what catharsis meant until like 3 years ago. And until I'm like, oh, I need to deal with some shit. But looking back on it, yeah, everything else was painted in this like pain in the ass at best. Everything that you did was a pain in the ass at best. Other than that, it was just dark. And getting together with your friends is always great. and being able to play music and release some of that and make new friends and connect on a level that you don't even have to talk about. Everybody knows what just happened. Is like an exponential feeling of like that outlet of getting out of your house and out of your work and out of these spaces just to go hang out. And there's no alcohol involved. Mm-hmm. It's just pure like experience with other people.
It was imperative when we were playing at that time that the Fatter Than Albert shows were all ages, and it was as much a drive to have that happen as also just those like high school age people were the ones that were coming to the shows. So if we wanted to play locally, it basically had to be all ages. And when we did an 18 and up show at the time, it wasn't as well attended, and it was always a headache, and it was like it had problems. So like for years and years, it was like all ages, or we're basically not playing. And occasionally we did do 18 and up because of we got booked on something, but that was not our.
When you have an all ages crowd going to an all ages venue, they're there to see the music. When you get these 18 and up, 21 and up shows, there's all these other reasons people are going to these shows. Mm-hmm. It's to get to drink, to socialize, to not really pay attention to the bands. Like there's just not in an insulting way or anything, it's just not part of the equation when you can't.
So I would push back a little bit on that in terms of all ages shows, because I think the kids do the same shit. And definitely my experience from booking shows at Cypress Hall, not to call you up, but my experience from booking shows at Cypress Hall was kids getting dropped off so they could drink and fuck off. And honestly, the first time I met, not the first time I met Greg, but his band, the pre-ska band.
Oh, Skycopter 4?
Skycopter 4. I can attest to the fact that I literally had to drag. They played a show at my old house, and I had to drag some kids out the house who cursed me up and down that they were 15 or 16. I wouldn't let them drink. How can you go to a show and have fun if you're not drinking? You know, and I'm like 23. I'm like, I'm gonna get arrested, and I'm gonna go to jail because you idiots are drinking at this show, and your parents are just gonna come pick you up. Like you gotta go. So
you're wrong.
I'm just saying this. You run through the same stuff with all ages shows. I mean, I agree that shows should be all ages, and I wholeheartedly attest to the fact that like Fire and Albert's crowd was kids, and so. What would be the point of playing an 18-plus show to nobody or a bunch of, like, jaded adults who don't care about ska punk or whatever? Like, why wouldn't you want to play to, like, 500 kids going crazy?
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
One thing that I used to do, and I mentioned earlier in this, on my Friday or Saturday nights for like the weeks, Fatter Than Albert would play about once a month locally. For the weeks leading up to the show, I would spend my Friday or Saturday nights, this is while I'm in college, I would drive out to Clearview Mall and go hand out flyers. Because that Clearview Mall was a place where parents would just drop their, was that? Club Clearview, you know, parents would just drop their kids off at the mall, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to where the kids are and go hand out flyers. And sure enough, a lot of the times we would switch back and forth between the Big Top and Cypress. So if we were playing at Cypress, I was like, well, you know, it's not that far to go down the street from Clearview Mall, blah, blah, blah. But getting all the way to like our crowd was high school kids, and we leaned into it. It wasn't, you know, okay, we need to shy away from this. It was like, this is where we're putting our energy, and it felt like it was resonating.
I mean, that's how it was before we were a band too, though. I started going to shows eighth grade. It was Marshall Flagg. His mom was my math teacher, and so she would give us flyers to all the poo-ass production shows. So I went and saw RX Bandits, Discover the Superflies, all that, and that brought a ton of kids into it. So the all ages scene had been around for, you know, pre us for sure.
You see those Fat and Hour stickers everywhere.
Oh, they're still around.
So Big Top, we already talked about Big Top a little bit, but I want to explain, or I want you to explain how, what the vision was and how it kind of came about. Was it Greg and J-Ray, was it your guys' idea, or Kira? Block Party. Jesus.
Oh, Block Party.
Yeah. Yes.
Sorry.
It was a combo. I kept saying you could open up both sides. You could do more. I was pushing you to do more. I remember that.
Well, you would call Block Party like an all-day festival, basically?
Yeah, absolutely. It was during French Quarter Festival. And French Quarter Festival does a great job of showcasing New Orleanian music that is all New Orleanian music, not punk or rock or ska, period. So we felt that that was a really good time to do it. And then
Well, it was my... So D-Ray was a junior in college, and I was a senior in college. It was like in the spring of that year. And I remember having this overwhelming feeling of, okay, going to graduate college, and then I will no longer be in a band because there will be no possible way for me to consider doing this with my life once I have to figure out how to pay bills and sustain myself and blah, blah, blah. So the Block Party was, when we did it the first time, I genuinely did not think that it would happen again. I was like, okay, once I'm out of college, there's no more music for me. And so the idea was, let's just throw the biggest possible ska, punk, I listed off the bands. There was not only ska bands there. There was a multitude of other things, but it felt like, it was a challenging idea because I was like, okay, we're essentially throwing a version of a music festival with no financial backing, with no promise that this will go well. What if it rains? What if XYZ, blah, blah, blah. And it really was Kira and the Big Top because we had to get the neighbors to sign off because we block off the street.
Yep.
There was a bus route that was close. So I had to go to City Hall, get the permit, set up the stage in the street. You helped connect us to the CAC. Mm-hmm. They let us borrow a stage. So D-Ray and I hauled a stage from the CAC to the Big Top to set it up.
And flood. It was raining, too.
Very rusty stage that flooded in Katrina. It's just like brown. It's just
right. Oh, yeah.
A tetanus hazard.
It was.
It's all being held up by cinder blocks. Had to level it somehow. The street's not level, so there's like pieces of just like brick
shim
holding it up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, in the streets. Took it outside.
But yeah, it was very much so a DIY effort, and the idea was let's throw a ska punk festival to the best of our ability at the time, as like being 21 years old.
What would you say? And now Block Party, you know, continues to this day. Was there a point where you felt like maybe it was like at its peak in terms of the amount of people that would come and be involved?
The 2011 year stands out, and then also last year stands out as the two big highlights.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about 2011 stands out to you?
That was the year that the RX Bandits played, and we shot the DVD. Mm-hmm. So we worked with our neighbors at the time in the house we were living. Zach Manuel is an incredible cinematographer, director, producer. And we hired them to shoot a documentary and film the festival, multi-track record the bands. It was like, I don't know how it happened because of all the logistics that went into Block Party to begin with. And then we also added on top of that this whole production, which involved building stands for the camera people to be on, getting Loyola to do the sound and do the recording and multi-track record everything, etc. But the main highlight was that the RX Bandits played, and they're like, may as well be like New Orleans ska heroes to a lot of people who have been doing this for a long time. And so that was the peak of that era, I feel like. And then this past year, the Bad Time Records tour came through. And so it was kind of like a full circle moment where now Bad Op is around and we're on this awesome record label. Fatter Than Albert did a reunion and it's at Tipitina's. It's, yeah, so that's, it's kind of like we went back up to this other peak in like a similar circular manner.
I watched the DVD and there's a moment in the DVD where Greg's explaining what Block Party is. And he says, it's like a DIY show times 10,000 or something.
Times
like that.
10.
Times 10. Yeah. Okay, well, I, for some reason I thought it was 10,000.
Whoa.
So, okay, we're in the 2007, 2008, you know, 2011. This is an era where, in the larger culture, there's not much discussion about ska being really having much place at all in culture. But there is sort of this sort of scene that's happening not just in New Orleans but mostly in the South and the East Coast, right? I mean, a little bit, not much, not as much in the West Coast or the Midwest, but it seems to me like there's this growing connection of bands that you guys are part of that are on the East Coast, Connecticut, New York, Tennessee, and you guys are all sort of building a scene together. Can you kind of talk about that, who these main bands were and how you started all connecting and how you built this bigger scene?
Yeah, I mean...
Starts with Stuck.
Yeah, and I'm trying to... Yeah.
I mean, it came out of Fatter Than Albert. Like, our connection to those bands came out of Fatter Than Albert touring. Right. So much... We were booking our tours DIY, and the idea... was, okay, we want to go to any other area of the country. We need to find the ska band in that town. And also, if there was any ska band coming to New Orleans, Fatter Than Albert had some, or Samurai Deli or Angry Banana, but like there were ska bands in New Orleans that were booking touring bands. And so that, you know, circuit, I guess you could say, or whatever, of us meeting these bands in other cities allowed for our friendship to be the beginnings of Community Records. Hunter mentioned Stuck Lucky, Public Access, Flaming Tsunamis, A Billion Ernies. Yeah.
And these bands, you know, including Fatter Than Albert, but these bands were ska punk and kind of a heavy version of ska punk and a version of ska punk that had like kind of complicated, you know, influences by Blue Meanies and RX Bandits and kind of bands doing a little bit more, you know, like trying to throw everything at it, right? This was kind of the sound of this scene of ska punk in the like late 2000s, early 2010s, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we were trying to take a genre that we all really cared about and loved and like trying to see how far we could stretch it and expound upon it with our musical knowledge of, you know, weird time signatures, weird chord voicings, weird everything. Just see how weird it can get, and also heavy music.
And so Community Records, which is Greg started, and then D-Ray, you were kind of early on.
Yeah, it
started with the two of us, basically. It's like it was my senior project. Like Community Records was, okay, I'm going to make an idea of a record label, and D-Ray was playing in Fatter Than Albert, and then I think like 5 or 6 months after the idea started, it was pretty obvious that D-Ray and I were going to be a team on Community Records, and the first couple of albums we put out was because of D-Ray and I working together.
And so would you say that Community Records was kind of the label for the scene that I just described?
Yeah, I mean, all those bands we released music for, or were on the comp and booked shows for, et cetera. Yeah, I mean, there wasn't another label. There was Kill Normal in Connecticut, but I think they had quit before Community started, or right at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, there certainly wasn't a DIY, like, ska punk record label.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even certain that that's what we were trying to do. It's just felt like it was happening. I can't even explain it, really.
When I think about ska and culture at this time, ska and mainstream culture, I think like, okay, Big D and the Kids Staple actually did penetrate culture a little bit. like, you know, maybe not in a huge way, but in enough of a way that they were out there. But I also think about how the band Vampire Weekend came out at that time, and they were really trying to dodge any hint of calling their music ska. And other people would kind of be like, you kind of sound like you got a little ska in there. And it was like, no, no, no. We are not a ska band. We have Caribbean and African influences in our music.
Well, hate to tell you what ska is.
No, but it's just really funny why Vampire Weekend this year are now like claiming their ska roots. Like, oh yeah, we wanted to be the fourth wave of ska. Like, they never said this shit in 2008. They would try to be very clear that they were not doing that. But now they were doing that, apparently.
It definitely happened with Community because mm-hmm. we like turned our backs completely on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember being in Chicago and they had a write up on us and we were all mad. Like, they were talking about how we just a ska band that decided to start playing emo, you know? So it's like,
yeah.
So then you're just like, no, you got to get mad at it, you know? So like, that definitely got me to hate all the Superfly stuff. And anybody would be like, play that stuff. And like, no, you know? So definitely 100% you at that time, you were going to try to distance yourself from like being in a ska band, which is ridiculous, I think, because it was cool, man. It was a cool scene.
Fire Is Real did the same thing.
Well,
they were 0.07. They became Fire Is Real.
Right. It's like you kind of graduate out of it, you know?
Well, it's kind of like, you know, this is the era of like the music blog, you know, Pitchfork and these music blogs are really kind of taking over, being the voice of like up and coming underground music. And any chance they got to trash ska, they took it. I mean, there's a Pitchfork review that it's about Alkaline Trio, not a ska band, but because they're an Asian man, or they just trash ska in the review.
They were slapstick, right? Wasn't Alkaline Trio slapstick or Broadway's?
Well, I mean, it was all from the
it was from the slapstick family tree.
They were a ska band.
No, no, there was no ska in Alkaline Trio.
No, not that band, but they were. That was like what Community did. Yeah. Like that. That's
it's a different. It's a different band, though.
So, absolutely.
Yeah. All right.
Now, see, it's happening now. Still, where's the inclusion?
I will say definitely. Okay, thinking about the years of 2006 to 2010 or 2011 of like trying to promote a ska band, there was an interesting thing where here in New Orleans, it felt like there were people coming out and people were at these shows, but I do distinctly remember going on tour and finding it very difficult to build any sort of momentum, get anyone to sort of give ska a chance, you know, so to speak, and almost to a point that it did exhaust us, where, I mean, D-Ray and I kind of stepped out of wanting to do ska in 2011, 2012, mm-hmm. mostly out of pure exhaustion of...
Yeah.
Trying to convince someone that it could be good or worth someone's time.
And I think the whole thing about people not wanting to claim the ska thing is interesting because it was the massive popularity of it, you know, a good thing that actually made people not want to associate with it, which is interesting. And it's a one style of ska that people like think of when they think of that. And I think it's just like a funny,
like Goldfinger.
Really like, yeah, it's like, so when we say ska, you get this picture, right? You get Real Big Fish, you get Goldfinger, but it's like there's so much more to that word and the genre, but it's just unfortunate that the thing that will forever, apparently, pop in people's mind when you say, I'm in a ska band, is not always great.
Yeah.
It's like nobody wants to see it. Nobody wants to come. They laugh. They go,
but we could also view it as...
told the dude from the Mountain Goats the other day when we were hanging out. He was like, oh, this is D-Ray. He's in Bad Operation. One of the best ska bands to come out.
I said it was the best ska band.
The best. You did.
Of the last 20 years.
Sorry. I would never.
Bad Operation.
But he had a small, like...
technically in 2019, right?
Sick, dude.
Yes. What would you say... And I just quit because I'm going to talk to other people. this, what would you say? Yeah. How would you say? I was like, no, you like it. It's kind of in the vein of Two-Tone. I had to say that.
Yeah.
So he would like that operation.
Over explanation thing that like. I think it is the you'll path towards bad operation because you just covered like the last 20 years of our life.
But bad operation is very different than that scene, that Fatter Than Albert. So I think there's something about
the whole scene. So to an extent, and I've talked about it a bit so far, the driving force of where my heart was with Fatter Than Albert was to have shows get people together to celebrate the sound of ska music. And Fatter Than Albert accomplished that in a way. You know, we brought people together. And I remember that feeling, and I wanted that feeling back. You know, I wanted to play, it was like, okay, I wanted to play a ska show. Like, Bad Operation was not about having Bad Operation for whatever it is. It was about playing literally just one ska show. That was the motivation. And it is so interesting, and there's other time to talk about this, but the motivation of having that one show that got the rug pulled under it from COVID starting, and then it turned into something else, like none of that could have been really predicted at the time, but the beginnings of whatever Bad Op is was just, we want people to get together, we want to dance, we want to have a good time, and not necessarily be so concerned about the other things that may or may not come from it wasn't a means to an end. It was just the thing in and of itself had goodness in it.
Yeah, similar to like, I feel like a common theme of what we're talking about of like getting people together to feel catharsis, to feel joy, to just, and I think we had spent a lot of time in bands trying to do who knows what, you know,
make it
or whatever, which we didn't even like want to do that. You know, we toured around in a veggie oil van and just like stunk and lost money for years. And I think it was just to do something for the joy of it again, to reach for that again. And that was the only goal. And that is still the goal with Bad Op. And now it's just turned into a bigger thing. It's like my favorite thing in the world as far as art and music goes in my life. And the fact that it's connecting with people is incredible too. And I count myself, like, looking around at like everybody that's on this panel today, and I feel like I feel so lucky to have like known all of these people and still know all of these people and continue this story that is, we're still writing it.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slo Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever.
Okay, there you go. I love that this conversation is now seeing the light of day. Little behind the scenes note for you. We thought about re-recording this entire conversation at one point.
But you know what? We did not.
Yes. Because lazy. No, it was actually because there was a scheduling problem and somebody couldn't do it. So we just used this one.
But you know what? There is more to this conversation. We did not play the entire panel recording. We saved some of it for the Patreon subscribers. So if you want to hear the rest of what we talked about, and it was mostly like a Q&A with the audience and some other delightful stuff, well then... Go grab yourself a couple $5 and shove them in your computer and go ahead and listen to it.
Get with it. Hey, folks. Once a month, our Patreon subscribers get a brand new bonus episode. These bonus episodes are completely different from our usual content. Here's a sample of the conversation we have waiting for you on our Patreon this month.
So over the life of the podcast, who continues to be like any white whales that you haven't gotten a chance to talk to yet, or maybe somebody that turned you down that you really wish they said yes?
I don't really get turned down so much as no replies. I honestly would still love to get anyone from No Doubt to come on the podcast. I've actually really been after Eric Stefani. That's kind of like, that's the member I'd really like, because he was the one that started the band. He was the one that envisioned the band, and he was pretty much the leader of the band up until the point he quit, which was partway through Tragic Kingdom. And he was the ska guy, you know, he was all about ska. So he's a big one. Eric Andre. Why not Eric Idle? I don't know. Let's have him come on too.
To get access to this episode and all of our exclusive backer content, go sign up for our Patreon today. That's patreon.com/indefenseofska. Ska now more than ever.
Offer valid on standard browsers, U.S. only.
When I heard about Date My Age, I thought, really? But there I was in my empty, quiet house, my laptop on the kitchen counter, and I typed in my name. Looking for a man between the ages of 40 to 60? Sure, why not?
Date My Age is different. With verified profiles, you can feel safe and secure to explore meaningful connections with interesting and mature singles.
Date My Age made it really easy. I could join and view online profiles for free. All of a sudden, my empty house wasn't so quiet anymore. I got so much attention, it just made me feel seen and alive. Date My Age helped me start a totally new chapter in my life.
Find a friend, a lover, a partner at Date My Age. Get 60% off when you join at datemyage.com today. That's datemyage.com to connect with thousands of singles worldwide. datemyage.com.